The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 10, 2025. The cover is, as usual, bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital letters, is in white. And it's superimposed upon the portrait, the face of a young woman. She has blonde hair. In fact, the blonde hair is in gradations of blondness, from white to an almost strawberry blonde. I don't know if that's the way the hair is or the way the photograph captured it. She has blue eyes, pink lips. She's looking askance from the camera, but the caption indicates it is Nicole Kidman. Women of the Year is also noted here. Beginning with the brief news, and it is a photograph, half a page photograph. Canine competition. Now, at first, I have to say, I thought these were beautiful, well-shorn, and yet fuzzy white sheep. But they are, in fact, Bedlington Terriers. Canine competition. They gather at the 149th annual Westminster Kennel Club show, dog show, at Jacob K. Javits Convention Center in New York City, February 11. Known by some as the Super Bowl of dog shows, Westminster is America's most prestigious dog competition. This year, Monty, the giant schnauzer, became the first of his breed to win the event's top award. Monty is not shown here, however. These beautiful four Bedlington Terriers are photographed, as well as the feet of two people, apparently their handlers, or the handlers of two of them. The bulletin is on the lower part of this page. Federal Aviation Administration layoffs spark air safety concerns. This is by Nick Popley. The nation's top aviation regulator was thrust back into the spotlight in February as the Trump administration fired hundreds of Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, employees just weeks after the mid-air collision over Washington, D.C., that killed 67 people. The firings, which primarily targeted probationary employees, are part of a broader push spearheaded by the new Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, an initiative associated with billionaire Elon Musk, established to streamline government operations. While no air traffic controllers were let go, the firings have raised concerns about the agency's ability to maintain essential functions at a time when it is already facing staffing shortages and increasing pressure from a recent string of accidents. Aviation safety experts are warning the cuts could further strain the agency. One FAA safety specialist who was let go and who spoke with Time on the condition of anonymity says she was part of a team that built and maintained aeronautical maps that aid pilots and air traffic controllers with navigation. She says she and two others, a quarter of the whole team, were laid off, compromising the quality of work that is vital for air safety. When you overstress understaffed critical support roles for the public safety, there will be consequences, she warns. Department of Transportation officials were quick to downplay the significance of the latest cuts, saying they primarily affected workers with less than 1 year of service and did not include air traffic controllers. Yet they come as the agency has faced criticism from President Donald Trump and others about its ability to function effectively. According to a report last year from the Government Accountability Office, a congressional watchdog, the FAA has struggled with workforce shortages and outdated technology for years. The report found that more than a third of the FAA systems were unsustainable, either because of being outdated or a shortage of spare parts. The GAO noted the agency has been slow to modernize and in some cases lacked clear plans to address certain critical systems. Here is the brief milestones page. It is a whole page, but there aren't too many articles on it. The first is the longest, confirmed. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as U.S. Health Secretary. This is by Chantel Lee. The Senate confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr., one of the country's most notorious vaccine skeptics, to run the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, on February 13, sparking outrage among public health experts who worry Kennedy will harm public health and further erode trust in science and medicine. I think it's a sad day for public health when someone who's a science denialist, conspiracy theorist, and virulent anti-vaccine activist is leading the biggest public health agency in the United States, says Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I think every senator who voted for his confirmation should be ashamed of themselves for their unwillingness to stand up for the health of the American public. For years, Kennedy, 71, has spread medical disinformation, including the debunked claim that vaccines cause autism, despite overwhelming research proving vaccines are both safe and effective. During his confirmation hearings, senators grilled Kennedy over his anti-vaccine views, flip-flopping stance on abortion, and previous support for some conspiracy theories, such as his assertions that Lyme disease and COVID-19 were engineered bioweapons. He appeared unfamiliar with certain issues he would oversee as head of HHS. All the same, Kennedy was confirmed by a vote of 52-48, with Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, a polio survivor, the only Republican who voted against his confirmation. Health experts fear the influence Kennedy will have over health policies, including vaccines, and how he will respond to emerging diseases. I think a lot of lives are at risk potentially because of this person running this agency, says Dr. Rob Davidson, executive director of the Committee to Protect Health Care. A second, shorter column here, ordered the end of the penny, deemed wasteful by Chad de Guzman. For far too long, the United States has minted pennies, which literally cost us more than 2 cents. This is so wasteful, President Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social platform February 9. I have instructed my Secretary of the U.S. Treasury to stop producing new pennies. It is unclear what the next steps will be after Trump's social media diktat, but he's not the first to propose ditching the 1 cent coin. Other countries around the world have already done so, amid concerns about the rising cost of production, as well as lack of everyday utility. But not everyone's on board. Some economists worry the poor would be hit hardest by a rounding tax on cash transactions. Other penny supporters point out that more nickels would need to be produced, and they cost over 13 cents each to make. And finally, there are four very short thumbnail sketches here at the bottom of the page. Died South Korean actor Kim Se-ron, S-A-E-R-O-N, at 24. Kim, who was found dead in her home February 16, struggled to land roles after a 2022 drunk driving incident. Police said Kim died by suicide. Released, Native American activist Leonard Peltier. From prison, February 18, after nearly 50 years. Former President Joe Biden commuted Peltier's sentence connected to the killings of two FBI agents. Raided the famous Palestinian-owned educational bookshop in East Jerusalem by Israeli police February 9. While the store remained open, the raid has sparked concerns over censorship. Announced the retirement of Senator Mitch McConnell next year in a speech February 20, his 83rd birthday. McConnell has had a 40-year career in Congress and was the longest-serving Senate leader in history. Oh, here, this is an ad on the verso of that page. We don't usually read ads, but I'll read this one to you. It's Purina, featuring a full-page photo of Monty, the 2025 Westminster Best in Show winner. Monty is the giant schnauzer. He's good-sized. He's sitting beside a big purple ribbon, a couple of silver-looking trophies, well, three, and apparently it's his handler next to him. It's a young-looking woman in a beige suit. Monty is gigantic and black, and he's a winner. Now I'm going to read eight questions. This is typically and truly is today also the last page in the magazine. It features a woman, as does this issue. Alice Park writes the column, which is question and answer. Halle Berry, H-A-L-L-E-B-E-R-R-Y, the Oscar-winning actor, says there's a desperate need to inform women about menopause. Her new company aims to fill that education and empathy gap. Halle Berry is pictured here. She's lovely. I don't know her age, middle-aged perhaps. She has light skin of color. She has dark eyes, a penetrating gaze at the camera. Her hair is short-ish. It is not quite shoulder length. It's parted in the middle, and it is wavy. She's smiling slightly at the camera. And this is question and answer six. Let's see if there are six. One, two, three, four, five, six. The first, then, how will your new company Respin or Respin, it's R-E-S-P-I-N, help women in menopause? Answer, women can get whatever level of support and care they need. A woman in her 30s can get educated about menopause. A woman in perimenopause can get a health coach and devise a plan for her needs. And a woman postmenopause can come for the services she needs, too. Question, how did your personal experience lead you to become an advocate for menopause? Answer, the more I started to talk about what I was going through, I started to realize how other women were suffering and how little other women had. I started to see the need to continue efforts in Washington to get a bill passed with substantive dollars for more research on midlife and more clinical trials for menopause. I saw the need for more education. I had no answers, no one to turn to. I was floored to find the nothingness in this space and how little doctors knew. I thought I had the best doctors I could have. Question, how are you working to change how we talk about menopause? Answer, we are working on the federal level to get the bill through and working at the state level, too, with governors and leaders. We are talking to them about what programs they might be willing to support in their states to support women. Question, why are more doctors not talking to women about menopause and midlife? Answer, it is not really their fault. It is not something that's made important for them in medical school. But what I hold against doctors today is that now that we are out there talking about it and screaming that women deserve better, that they do not go back to take it upon themselves to get an education. Every practitioner should know about the menopausal body. Women are living to their 80s, and menopause can start in your 40s. We spend half our lifetimes in it now. If men went through this time of life in the same horrific way we do, with symptoms of hot flashes, night sweats, and mood changes, there would be lots of answers, research, and a lot of money raised to fund studies to help men live their best lives. But because we're women, we suffer sexism and ageism. When we're done making babies, we're left to fend for ourselves. No one cares about us anymore. Question, how can women change the current stigma and lack of knowledge about menopause? Answer, there are so many ideas and information and misinformation swirling around. That's why I created ReSpin. It's a community for women to talk to each other and learn from each other. But there's also a health component with health coaching, nutritionists, experts to talk about exercise and learning how the lack of estrogen and changing hormones affect our heart, brain, bones, and entire body. I felt like there was something really missing in the market for women in midlife. And the final question, how can the medical system change to be more supportive and knowledgeable? Answer, that's my next crusade after I get the bill passed in D.C. for more research and clinical trials. I'm going to the universities and put pressure on them, too. We need to help them understand why this is important and reimagine their curriculum to make menopause and midlife for women more than one chapter in medical school textbooks. And this is not just for gynecologists. This is not bikini medicine. Every doctor, every cardiologist, every neurologist, every general practitioner, every rheumatologist should understand the effect that a woman's loss of her hormones does to her body and every single one of her organs. We women have to start demanding more. That's who I am today, a woman demanding more. I'm demanding more because we deserve more. And Alice Park wrote that based upon questions to Halle Berry. The brief news, health, NIH budget cuts are causing chaos. This is by Alice Park. The U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, is the largest funder of biomedical research in the world, and its grants create the foundation of basic science knowledge on which major health advances are built. February 14, as part of the Trump administration's cost-cutting measures, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, which oversees the NIH, said it was terminating nearly all of the 5,200 probationary employees at HHS. The news came after another drastic change the NIH announced February 7 to cut overhead costs in the funding it provides to research grants. We were all just dumbstruck, says Dr. Richard Hugenier, professor and chairman of the Department of Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, who relies on NIH grants for his research into therapies for autism and intellectual disabilities. I am calling it the apocalypse of American science. This will basically change science as we know it in the U.S. We are going to see health research kneecapped, says Dr. Otis Brawley, professor of oncology and epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Brawley, that's B-R-A-W-L-E-Y, has overseen grants at the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the NIH, as well as received them for his cancer research. The funding cut took effect February 9 and targets indirect costs, which cover facilities and administrative expenses. In an immediate response, 22 states sued the NIH and the HHS, calling the action unlawful and saying it would devastate critical public health research at universities and research institutions in the United States. A federal judge in Boston also issued a nationwide temporary restraining order, preventing the NIH from immediately cutting billions in the grants it issues to scientists and their institutions. NIH awards around $30 billion to $35 billion in grants each year to a wide range of disease-related research projects. According to the agency, about $9 billion of its annual research grant budget goes toward indirect costs, which are charged by academic institutions receiving the grants. These costs are negotiated with the NIH and vary among institutions, accounting for fees for heat, air conditioning, electricity, inside research facilities, as well as administrative costs required to conduct the research. They also cover the maintenance and staffing of critical scientific equipment and resources such as animal facilities, DNA sequencing, and imaging. Once a rate agreement is reached, it applies to all federal grants from NIH to that institution. Indirect costs can range from about 30% to 70% of a research grant and are paid in addition to the grant. NIH will now cap those costs at 15%. The agency did not immediately respond to a request about what prompted the change, but on February 7, Elon Musk, tasked by the Trump administration to address efficiency in government spending, called out on X, which he owns, the high percentage of indirect costs that the NIH had been supporting. So far, it's unclear how institutions will make up the difference. While university endowments are a possibility, they are not a consistent or practical source of funding for overhead costs, since many specify narrow purposes or projects for which the funds can legally be used, which do not include costs such as research expenses. Nobody can really afford to pay for it, says Brawley. What's worked nicely over the last 50 to 60 years is that the NIH does a lot of basic science research, asking questions that people cannot make money from. And the corporations, including biotech, can swoop in and take that basic science information and do engineering and turn it into things you can sell and treat diseases with. The immediate effect of the reduction in indirect costs, if they are instituted, could drastically shrink how much of that basic research happens. The bottom line is that we're going to have a lot less resources, which obviously means we're going to have to lay people off and research will be slowed down, says Huganier. That's spelled H-U-G-A-N-I-R. Brawley's also concerned about the ability of young scientists to pursue innovative research. Nobody wins the Nobel Prize for what they did when they were 50, he says. He also notes that while a lot of attention has been focused on large academic universities with big endowments and deeper financial resources, the policy will likely have an even stronger impact on smaller community hospitals that supply many of the patients who participate in clinical trials. People who are getting treated in clinical trials now for cancer will find many of those trials will close down, he says. Then there's the effect that curbing research today will have on the pipeline of new treatments for diseases like cancer. I anticipate the number of drugs approved is going to go down dramatically in the next 5 to 10 years, says Brawley. With the temporary restraining order, NIH grantees have some time to come up with a plan for how they will try to maintain the pace of scientific research with much less NIH support. Perhaps we need to reimagine or re-envision our entire system for how we fund science and how people make money off of science, says Brawley. But the way to do that is not to threaten on a Friday night to cut everybody's indirect costs down to 15%. Ultimately, scientists say disinvestment will cost the public. The American public should know this is going to impact them, the health of their families and their children, says Huguenier. There's a small photo here. Well, it's not real small, but it isn't even a fourth of the page. It's a woman. She's seated at a piece of equipment which really looks like kind of a modernistic white and silver kitchen cabinet. There's a computer screen in the background. The woman's wearing a lab coat, white and blue gloves, and she's reaching into a compartment within this futuristic-looking kitchen cabinet. And the caption reads, "Equipment like this cell sorter at UC Riverside is supported by NIH grants." Next, under technology, and this is written by Billy Perigo, Paris. U.S. leads pivot against AI safety. Safety concerns are out. Optimism is in. That was the takeaway from a major artificial intelligence summit in Paris in February, as world leaders jettisoned talk of safety and embraced growth. The focus of the two-day meeting was markedly different from earlier gatherings. The summits began in the UK in 2023 with a sharp focus on fears that progress in AI was occurring without parallel advancements in safety. The concern that increasingly powerful AI systems could be misused by terrorists or rogue states, or even become autonomous and turn against their human creators. The gap between AI capabilities and safety has not changed since 2023, but the global political mood certainly has. A declaration signed by 60 nations in Paris made no mention of catastrophic AI risks nor attempts to mitigate them. The U.S. did not sign, apparently in protest against the document's diversity-focused language. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance told the summit, "I'm not here this morning to talk about AI safety," and argued against the need for AI regulations while associating the field with wokeness. The French leader, Emmanuel Macron, also sent a pro-business message using a speech to boost the French AI and energy industries. Only the UK appeared to hold a flame for AI safety, declining to sign the declaration over what officials said was a lack of substance. Last year in Seoul, governments and AI companies agreed to come to Paris, prepared with red lines for AI, risk thresholds that if passed would trigger international action. But there was no effort in Paris to discuss such red lines, let alone turn them into an international agreement. "This was a real belly flop," says Max Tegmark of the Future of Life Institute, a nonprofit focused on mitigating AI risks. Anthropic, an AI company focused on safety, called the event a missed opportunity. The shift came against a backdrop of intensifying developments in AI. In January, OpenAI released a model that some users said can perform research tasks at roughly the level of a PhD student. Safety researchers, meanwhile, found the latest generation of AI models are capable of deceiving their creators, copying themselves onto servers in an attempt to avoid modification. Many independent AI scientists now agree with the projections of the tech companies themselves that superhuman-level AI may be developed within the next 5 years, with potentially catastrophic effects if unsolved questions in safety research are not addressed. Yet such worries were pushed to the back burner, as the U.S. in particular made a forceful argument against moves to regulate the sector. We believe excessive regulation of the AI sector could kill a transformative industry just as it's taking off, and we will make every effort to encourage pro-growth AI policies, Vance said in his speech. Meanwhile, Yoshua Bengio, a so-called godfather of AI, who had been commissioned by governments at the first AI Safety Summit in 2023 to author a State of the Science report on AI risks, was relegated to introducing his finished report at a side event. His main policy recommendation? That autonomous AI agents are highly dangerous and should not be built until scientists know how to properly constrain them against carrying out dangerous acts. We've tried, he told Time, but we have not succeeded in figuring this out. The U.S. leads pivot against AI safety by Billy Perigo, with reporting by Harry Booth and Taryn Pillay, Paris. The Brief Health. 5 ways to shorten your wait for a doctor's appointment by Angela Haupt. If you have tried to schedule a doctor's appointment recently, you might have had to flip your calendar to a different season. There simply are not enough physicians in the U.S. Going by current demand for health care, by 2037, the deficit is expected to reach 187,130 doctors, including more than 8,000 cardiologists and 4,000 nephrologists. That means patients routinely wait a long time, an average of 38 days, according to some data, before they're able to snag an appointment with a doctor they really need to see. People are constantly trying to get in to see doctors, says Dr. Gerda Meisel, a physician and patient advocate in New York, who helps people navigate the healthcare system. She once worked with a man who wanted to see a specialist at a major academic center about his worsening neurological disease. After he accepted an appointment 10 months down the road, he and his wife were just beside themselves, she recalls. He had a tremendous need, and the academic center was just like, yeah, sorry, everybody wants that specialist. Thousands of different versions of that story unfold every single day for patients across the country, she says. Long waits for necessary care can add emotional distress during an already stressful time and open the door to conditions that are not caught or treated in time. Fortunately, patients can sometimes take steps to get in sooner. We asked experts to share the most effective ways to see a specialist as soon as possible. 1. Check if the office has multiple locations. Many doctors see patients in a variety of locations, some of which are busier than others. Always ask for the wait time at alternative locations, advises Sarah Matthew, Associate Director of Research and Operations Administration at Weill Cornell Medicine. Flexibility's your friend when you're in a hurry to see a doctor. 2. Make sure you are on the cancellation list. let the receptionist know you would like to be notified if an earlier appointment opens up, and mention you could drop everything to be there if that is, in fact, the case, says Christina Robertson, a regional director for Reproductive Medicine Associations, where she oversees the patient scheduling team. Ask their percentage of canceled appointments, she suggests, as well as whether those cancellations usually happen the same day or a few days in advance. That can help set your expectations. 3, ask your doctor to call on your behalf. Depending on the situation, your primary care physician or other referring doctor may call on your behalf. Sometimes that will encourage the specialist staff to squeeze you in. I would not abuse that for every kind of diagnosis, Matthew says, but if you went for a routine GI checkup and they notice something on your gallbladder or colon and there's a possibility it could be cancer, find every way to get in faster. 4, make a personal plea. Request to speak to a practice manager, suggests Nicoletta Sozanski, founder of the patient advocacy company Healthcare Redefined. That's what Sozanski did when her daughter needed to see a specialist. She asked the manager if she could write doctors an email making the case to be seen soon. It worked. This letter opened the door to every pediatrician we reached out to, she says. From what I've experienced, doctors who are treating complex cases like your stories, they like a challenge. Let me reread that. From what I've experienced, doctors who are treating complex cases like your stories, they like a challenge. And last, 5, consider providers who are not physicians. Nurse practitioners and physician's assistants tend to have greater availability. In some offices, these providers are very much like an extension of the physician, Meisel says. They'll work closely with the doctor to figure out how to best treat you. In other offices, they operate more independently. In general, if I have to choose between waiting 6 months or seeing the NP next week, I'm going to see the NP next week, she says. These providers can get testing started and often spend more time addressing your needs. Plus, once you're a patient at the practice, you often have an easier time getting an appointment with the provider you want. And indeed, there's a little cartoon illustration here with number 5. It's a person in green scrubs with a stethoscope around their neck and an NP badge on the front of the shirt. From the front page of The View, this is Nation, American Broligarchy, Broligarchy. I'm going to say Broligarchy, by Lawrence Norden and Daniel I. Weiner. Norden is vice president and Weiner is director of the Elections and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law. As Elon Musk, the world's richest person, and President Donald Trump's top campaign donor, rampages through the federal government, shutting down agencies and firing workers seemingly without any regard for his own conflicts of interest, the danger of concentrated private interests capturing our political system has never been more apparent. This is a one-page article. How did we get to the point of having a tech billionaire campaign donor openly running huge parts of the federal government? As a result of Supreme Court decisions, most notably the notorious 2010 Citizens United, the wealthiest donors can play a more direct role in funding and running political campaigns than we have seen since the Gilded Age. In 2024, just 10 individual donors were able to supply nearly half the money raised to support Trump's candidacy. Musk spent at least $288 million, and his PAC took on core functions of the campaign, such as door-to-door canvassing and get-out-the-vote efforts. He also used ownership of X, formerly Twitter, to boost Trump. Before Citizens United, none of this would have been legal. Presidents from both parties have eroded laws and norms meant to restrain their power, increasingly without the pushback from members of their own party that held back their predecessors, including FDR. Trump has accelerated this process, issuing a number of seemingly unconstitutional executive orders and directives. Courts have temporarily blocked some, but ultimate review will be in the hands of the Supreme Court, which has itself taken a chainsaw to legal constraints on the president's power over the executive branch, gutting the independence of key federal agencies, and most recently holding that former presidents are immune from prosecution, even for certain blatantly illegal abuses of power. The combination of unregulated money in politics and expanded presidential power with fewer checks from Congress would be a recipe for more corruption under any president, but there are special dangers when they combine with Trump's explicitly transactional approach to wielding power. The president campaigned openly on the promise to reward friends and punish enemies. He has once again, as in his first term, refused to meaningfully separate from his private business empire. There are plenty of indications corporate leaders have gotten the message. Media companies that offended him are rushing to settle even seemingly meritless private lawsuits. And before Trump was even inaugurated, a Chinese billionaire who's fighting a fraud lawsuit from the Securities and Exchange Commission poured $30 million into a new crypto venture started by the president and his family. Meanwhile, leading technology corporations have gained massive power over our political system. The seven largest tech companies in the U.S. represent approximately one-third of the value of the S&P 500. Trump seated the leaders of three of them, Musk, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, ahead of cabinet members and world leaders at his inauguration. These wealthiest of tech bros are also players. As journalist Ezra Klein notes, in the so-called attention economy, its products have increasingly replaced traditional media as the source of political information for Americans, often tailored based on their personal data that the same companies collect, and largely unaccountable for how it can manipulate our understanding of reality. The situation's dire but not hopeless. The U.S. is still a democracy with a decentralized electoral system that is not easy to fully subvert. As we've seen in previous eras of political corruption, including Watergate, the powerful tend to overreach and prompt a backlash that opens the door to reform. Eventually, Congress must do more to fully reassert its authority as the first branch of government, by not only restraining the worst impulses of the Trump administration, but also passing bold campaign finance, ethics, and rule of law reforms that restore meaningful guardrails against self-dealing by those in power, undo as much as possible the damage done by Citizens United and other decisions, and ultimately lay the groundwork for reversing them. Finally, place meaningful checks on both presidential power and the emerging tech broligarchy. Failing to restore Americans' sense of ownership over their own government could be a mistake from which our democracy might not recover. And after all that, Time Off, Facing the Abyss by Rachel Sonis, S-O-N-I-S, Michelle Zauner, Z-A-U-N-E-R, new album with Japanese Breakfast explores the many ways in which sadness pervades modern womanhood. Michelle Zauner wants to set the record straight. She's not trying to reclaim the label Sad Girl Music. Since announcing the title of her highly anticipated fourth studio album for Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women, the author, director, and frontwoman of indie pop band Japanese Breakfast has been surprised to see how divisive the title has become and the assumptions it's given way to. Some thought she was writing a collection of sad breakup songs. Others, she was taking ownership of a label that has previously been wielded with the intent to belittle or insult. I think the album title was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, Zauner says with a chuckle over Zoom in early February, and it was maybe taken very literally. Sad girl music is a fraught subject, and Zauner chooses her words carefully. I don't want to get into trouble, she says, explaining that a lot of brilliant women songwriters get unfairly punted into that category. And it's true. The music industry and the internet have made a nasty habit of reducing songwriting by women that deals with complex emotions in this way. Phoebe Bridgers, Mitski, Lana Del Rey have had to fend off these degrading designations for years. Zauner, though, is interested to see what people will say once they've had a listen to the project in its entirety. With the album due March 21, Zauner, 35, finds herself in a constant state of caring, then not caring, then pretending to care. Her mood matches the weather outside our windows. I'm a winter person, in the sense I feel like I must suffer through something to enjoy the coming season, she says and laughs heartily. The stakes feel high after her past few years, for Melancholy Brunettes arrives 4 years after Zauner's rise from indie music darling to literary heavyweight with the release of her wildly successful gut-punching memoir, Crying in H. Mart, which explored her Korean-American identity and her relationship with her late mother, Chongmi, who died of cancer in 2014. Written in arresting, empathetic prose, it became an instant New York Times bestseller and is currently in its 39th printing. Zauner followed up Crying in H Mart with Japanese Breakfast's third studio album, Jubilee. Unlike the book, the album took a sharp turn away from grief into cathartic joy, blending dreamy synth-pop chords with shoegaze sensibilities. It was equally met with critical success, earning the group nominations for Best New Artist and Best Alternative Music Album at the 2022 Grammys. For Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women, though, is worlds away from the sonic landscape of Jubilee. It's not quite in the sphere of Crying in H Mart either. Here, Zauner's exploring something bleaker, crueler, more punishing. She's trying to see what darkness of all different kinds looks like when you stare it right in the face. When I ask what comes to mind when Zauner thinks of Melancholy Brunettes, she excitedly whips out her phone to rattle off some references. Paintings like L'Absinthe by Edgar Degas, Tired by Ramon Casas, and The Wedding Dress by Frederick Elwell, all interpretations of women experiencing massive despair, were hugely informative to the record. They were especially important to the album art, which sees Zauner looking like a gothic, Bronte-esque character, face down on a table, surrounded by a plentiful feast. I like the idea of being someone just collapsed on a table, surrounded by a wealth of goods, like a spoiled prince or something, she explains. When Zauner began writing for Melancholy Brunettes in the winter of 2022, she was clear she wanted to do something from a more introspective place. As she began piecing the songs together, Zauner was also reading a lot. She wanted to explore how the concept of melancholy has evolved in stories of love and longing, society and familiar relationships, over time. She worked her way from European Romanticism to Greek mythology, before turning to Gothic romance classics like Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, and Frankenstein, and even modernist staples like The Magic Mountain by German author Thomas Mann, which is her husband and fellow bandmate Peter Bradley's favorite book and directly inspired a song on the album. She also became increasingly fascinated with works that could be categorized as part of the incel canon, Zahner says, books that the mostly male subculture of self-described involuntary celibates has glorified for their depiction of loneliness and manhood. Think American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis and Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Zahner hoped to better understand why this type of confused masculinity and Joker-like anger and loneliness emerges. How those aggrieved and occasionally violent men process the world. If I look back at my very early work, it's always been there, this fear of men, she says. There's this disappointment and fear of men and these creepy stories, like an ominous thing has happened or is about to happen, that threads the songs together. Indeed, listening to the new album feels not unlike your Cathy or Heathcliff staring at the misty English moors, or as impending doom envelops you from all angles. On Honey Water, a woman finds herself in a marriage to a slimy, unfaithful man and equates him to a thirsty bug. On Mega Circuit, a lustful spectator watches a gang of incels meander around over a feverish, sinister guitar shuffle. On Little Girl, perhaps one of the most devastating ballads on the record, a father, urinating in a corner of a lonely hotel room, wonders how he became estranged from his daughter. 7 years of running at this breakneck speed, convalescing cheaply far abroad, dreaming of a daughter who won't speak to me, running for her father coming home. Dramatic as they may seem, these sentiments are strikingly relatable. Feelings of yearning and amorphous despair on an album releasing in the middle of a public health crisis of loneliness. The lyrics, the storytelling, the sparse, meticulous melodies, it's also beautifully punishing, and that is exactly the point. After her mom died, Zahner says, she became very work-obsessed. While work was a grounding force, it came at a cost. I kind of lost track of any form of self-care, personal life, or family and friends. Following the release of Crying in H Mart and then Jubilee and a much-needed sabbatical in Korea, Zahner found herself thinking about what it means to be a creative working woman in her mid-30s, the price one pays for their ambitions. It was playing on Zahner's mind a lot as she was making For Melancholy Brunettes, especially when she thought about balancing her work with expanding her family. There's this anticipatory grief about wanting to become a mother and having to reckon with the creative loss that will usher in, Zahner says. I was thinking about how much I've excused men for poor behavior because of their positions of power and the work they've had to do to provide for their family. Now, as Zahner has grown into her creative career, she questions the elusive balancing act between the narcissism that comes with being an artist and the desire to be a good human being. It is what drew her to write the album's lead single, Orlando in Love. Inspired by John Cheever's nod to Orlando Innamorato, an unfinished epic poem by the Renaissance poet Matteo Maria Boiardo, the song's equal parts a story about a foolish romantic guy who succumbs to a siren's call and Zahner's personal reflection on success. You're pursuing your dreams in a very foolhardy way, and sometimes you're punished for just how straight you're going with it, she says. Like if you go too far in your ambitions, it likely will not end well. The 2025 Grammys happened a week before Zauner and I spoke, and the internet was still buzzing, not only from Beyoncé's finally winning Album of the Year, but another artist who unequivocally spoke their mind that night, Chappell Roan. Roan, who received the Grammy for Best New Artist, got up to the podium and called out the record industry for not supporting emerging artists with necessities like a livable wage and health insurance. When Zauner heard this, she immediately took to X to congratulate Roan, writing, F space CK, ya, Chappell. That got her in a bit of trouble. Some people interpreted ya, Y-A, to mean an insulting you, instead of an enthusiastic yes. Zauner couldn't believe it. Let the record show. I thought it was amazing, and I think it's so ridiculous how much crap she has to endure for all the good she's putting in the world. She inspires me to be a more outspoken, braver artist, Zauner says. Having been nominated in the same category, she finds it a bit funny that these award shows so aggressively avoid naming the problems that plague the same industry they're celebrating. But Roan, she says very eloquently and very courageously, said exactly what the problem is. Perhaps that's what For Melancholy Brunettes and Sad Women is trying to do too, naming the problem, and hoping that despite the scars, the battle wounds, the punishment, the castigations, we'll all come out the other end into the light. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.